This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
Our focus in this session is on the period of 1989 to 96, or at least that's the way it is in the program, in the Soviet Union and post-Soviet Russia. It's pre-Putin, in other words, or Gorbachev and Yeltsin, if you will. And that's often equated with an effort at a transition to democracy. Some people argue that it succeeded, other people argue that it failed. I'm sure we'll be getting into that, but we have two distinguished speakers today who have spent a good deal of their time thinking through these kinds of questions about what to make of the Soviet and post-Soviet experience in the late 80s and 90s. The first speaker will be Jeremy Kinsman, whom those of you who were here yesterday will recognize, because this is his second panel presentation. He's the resident international scholar at the Institute of the Institute of Governmental Studies at UC Berkeley, and the distinguished visiting diplomat at Ryerson University, Toronto. He directs an international democracy support project for the Community of Democracies. And during his long career in the Canadian government, he rose to become one of Canada's foremost diplomats and voices on foreign policy. From 1989 to 92, he was the political director of the Foreign Ministry in Ottawa. From 1992 to 2006, he was the Canadian ambassador or high commissioner in Moscow, but also in Rome, in London, and Brussels. He is now the lead writer on foreign affairs for the magazine called Policy Options, and he also appears in many other print and electronic media outlets. Jeremy.
Здравствуйте. Thank you, Provost. As you know, several of us have spoken, and Larry Mikulak spoke today of the so-called Diplomat's Handbook for Democracy Development Support. Several people have asked me, though it's online, if they could have a hard copy. And I just wanted to say that a couple of dozen hard copies have just been FedExed in, and they will be available at the next panel, free of charge, courtesy of Berkeley. I lived in Russia roughly for the period of Boris Nikolaevich Yeltsin's first term. And it made an enormous mark on me. I speak with humility about Russia before people like Marcia Lipman here, who, Strasvite, the hockey player over here, because I'm not Russian. But what I have always tried to do has been to try to understand what it is to be Russian. I don't believe being Russian is quite the mysterious thing that some, like Churchill, have made it out to be. I think Russians are different. I'm Canadian. I'm different. I may not seem so different to you, but I'm different, and Russians seem more different, and maybe they are more different. But I'm sure that the Russian scholars among you, Steve, the provost, Ned, agree with me that Russia is a place that one can understand objectively and comprehensively. It's not an enigma wrapped in a riddle and a mystery and all that sort of stuff. So I wanted to make that point, first of all. The second point is that when we put this conference together, we chose to look at the experience of attempts to transit to democracy through the prism of what we heard so brilliantly this morning about the so-called Arab Spring, and then about Russia. We weren't premising at all that the Russian experience necessarily, and particularly this winter, drew from what was happening in Tahrir Square. But it's interesting, as I listened this morning, to see how many common features there actually were in the two experiences. And I hope we'll be able to draw that out. Of course, the Russian experience that I'm going to describe is one, to a large extent, of disappointment. Of disappointment of many of the aspirations that the hundreds of thousands of Russians that I saw gather in Moscow at the very end of the 80s and the beginning of the 90s, that it didn't work out. I say to you, and I hope you will correct me if you believe I'm wrong, it is also a story of disappointment in ourselves. I lived there. I gave advice. I was around people who gave them advice on matters which we, no more than them, just didn't understand. Secondly, they didn't understand them, and they made great mistakes. If we had done what we said we were going to do, and if we had given great advice, perhaps it might have gone a little better. But make no mistake, the Russian transformation is an excellent example, because in the course of something as large as human history, no society, to my knowledge, had ever tried to come from so far to get so far. The voyage was the longest, the scale was the hugest, the complexity of transformation that was being asked was the greatest. So even if we had got it right, and even if the reformers had got it right, and circumstances had been slightly different, it still would have been one hell of a challenge for them to have succeeded in the short space of time that they were trying, in effect, to develop institutions that took us 150 years. I was struck, Paul Wilson had a little piece in the New York Review of Books a couple of months ago, and he had this line in it: "The knowledge of how democracies can be lost may be as valuable an instrument of democracy as an understanding of how they are won." And so that's, to some extent, my story. Russia's importance, I'll make it, this whole experience was unprecedented. And when we heard this morning about Tunisia, that there was no user's manual for Tunisia, there sure as hell wasn't a user's manual for Russia. And remember that this cataclysmic transformation that occurred was simultaneous with something else. A peaceable retreat from an empire. And it's all the more surprising because it was an adjacent empire. It was not an empire across the seas like the British Empire or the French Empire. And it involved major population shifts, though perhaps not immediately. Throughout the decade, as disillusion set in and democracy became associated with economic and social chaos, which was the case, there was a delayed psychological impact with a nationalist resonance because of that loss of something, which was blamed on the West. Now, for Russians, Gorbachev ended the Cold War, and most people in the West, and certainly myself, agree. Democracies responded positively, of course, as you'll remember. But we mismanaged our opportunity because we got our role wrong. We assumed that we were meant to attach our labels to their change, or they were meant to attach our labels to their change. That somehow we were there to help Russians be more like us. And we didn't follow the very first rule of effective public diplomacy, which is to listen. We couldn't and we didn't imagine effectively what it was like to be Russian. I'm going to deal with this by just covering, because the subject is so vast, certain component dimensions of Russian transformation. And the first dimension is that of time. Transformation takes time. The sad thing is Russian reformers believed they had very little time to do what they were going to do. Time dictated their critical choice of shock therapy over gradualism. Gaidar, in 92, I remember talking frankly about putting all our eggs in one basket. Once Anatoly Chubais, the so-called privatization czar, asked me, rhetorically, how do you decontrol a totalitarian society in a controlled way? And of course, you probably can't. Our advice basically supported the choice of shock therapy, but the complexities of this choice, and above all the social and hence the political costs, were completely beyond our comprehension or our anticipation because we had no experience in it. Now, the reformers rushed into a short-term game of stark change because of short-term electoral cycle issues. That growing opposition would build on unrest and close the window. A very good example is Chubais and the Loans for Shares operation in anticipation of what they expected would be a communist victory in the 1996 presidential elections. And Chubais needed to lock privatization in. What was the outcome? It created oligarchs. It provided an enormous impression of unfairness and had a terrible political impact. Now, you can argue in the context of time, taking a longer view, that time partly vindicates some of those decisions. I don't know what you would think, Masha. But I'm interested to know that as a fact, that the new companies created out of state assets under the Loans for Shares scheme, I think of Sibneft, I think of Yukos Oil, I think of Norilsk Nickel, have outperformed the rest of the Russian economy by multiples of dozens. They've become growth engines. They've become Western in methods. They've become channels for vital skill transfers. So in one way, you might conclude, that over time, the long game of privatization actually worked. Now, the West had its own time calendar that made for false moves. The enormous pressure to expand NATO. I don't want to get into that, but it had to happen eventually. But it certainly, that pressure, it would have been so much better if that could have been delayed. The 94 midterm elections in this country, in which Clinton lost a huge number of seats, he lost in that his political capacity to counter congressional obstruction on Russia, including non-repeal of Jackson-Vanik, if you know what I'm talking about, which is just lunacy that at that time it still persisted. In 1996, I remember Václav Havel said that Russia would get inclusive democracy in 50 or 100 years. It was probably too dark. But in general, Russia needed more time. It needed more time, more distance in time from the overthrow and experience of communism. Time to replenish exhausted human capital. Time to overcome the chaos and disruption of transformation. Time to feel normal. Enjoy the gift of private lives for the first time in three generations. And time, as Ilya Aronov said, to have a breather. I think that time has passed, and that's what the next panel's about. capacity. It can't occur all at once. It needs sequencing. The capacity for transformative change is built over time, not just for state institutions, but in civil society. Civil society is the building blocks of democratic change. Russia didn't have what's called the virtuous circle necessary to complete change. Gorbachev decentralized the system abruptly. As inefficient, illogical enterprises shut, there was no functioning backup market capacity to fill the supply gaps. As the price of oil dropped 50%, no fault of his, the cost of food imports that were necessary broke the state budget. You know, the need for an effective market was understood, but the issue of sequencing was not. A functional market would need a regulatory framework, laws on property, taxation, an independent professional judiciary, and ultimately a middle class. It takes time. And helping Russians to build that capacity should have been our overwhelming goal as Western democracies. Instead, we piled on the enthusiasm, as we were hearing from Mahmoud this morning, for just stripping away the state system in a neoliberal way in favor of market forces, unregulated, essentially out of control. Behavior, democracy is behavioral. Conversion to inclusive democratic practice with individual accountability, responsibility. It's not a process, it's not an app you can download, transfer. And yet, we believed that democracy then was irreversible, even though people hadn't learned it. Rule of law, as David Caron said yesterday, is much more than statutes and courts. As Tom Carruthers has said, it's what resides in the heads of citizens. I'll give you, look, we were talking earlier, Steve, Yeltsin's 1993 Constitution. Ned, it was a beautiful document from a democratist's point of view. He rammed it over the obstructive Duma. A fine democratic rule of law framework. It just hasn't been observed. Behavior can't be imported. You know, it can be mimicked. And the Russians, if you forgive me for saying this, they mimicked it. People in economics mimicked our language. They got the vocabulary. But without really understanding its essence, it has to be grown. And Russian reformers didn't grasp this dimension, but neither did Westerners. Behavior on the part of Westerners, style, I tell you, it was insensitive. The assumption was we were the norm givers, they were the norm takers. We thought it was adequate to show how we did things in New York and Frankfurt without realizing what it was like to be them living where they live with their capacities as they were. Now, we were very careful about not naming winners and losers. George Bush, the first, and Jim Baker were assiduous in avoiding triumphalism. But Russians began to feel like losers. It wasn't just the episodes like unilateral NATO bombing of Serbia, but it was the appearance, the effect, the feeling they had. They were no longer being taken seriously. I remember Tony Blair saying incautiously, they're not a superpower, but we have to pretend they are. Well, Russians felt the insincerity of that pretense. Pollster Lev Gutkov cited a complex of defeat and humiliation, even of neurotic sensitivity. The point is, we just didn't get it. Democracy needs consensus. Russia needed consensus. You know, there are a few uprisings that lead to thorough overthrows of existing orders. I guess you'd put Lenin in that category. Recent ones, I suppose Castro, and maybe Prague in 89. But usually what you need, and we heard about this morning about Egypt, what you need is pacting. Pacting between old and new orders to manage transition and security, to avoid today's Libya. Pacting involves the old power centers buying into the new deal. Examples of post-military pacting are just abound. Spain, Brazil, Greece, Chile, and maybe today, right now, Burma. And it's obviously going to have to be part of the endgame on Syria. And in other transitions, which are non-military, like South Africa, truth and reconciliation help to put the past behind in a form of pacting. But it didn't happen in Russia. It stayed polarized. Not the army was not the issue. It was the nomenklatura, very much what we heard about Tunisia this morning, which dug in to oppose Gorbachev. They could not swallow the truth inherent in the Yakovlev-Gorbachev address to the 70th anniversary of the October Revolution Congress, when Gorbachev accused the Communist Party of real crimes based on the abuse of power and mass repressions that were immense and unforgivable. You know, there was a General Accounting Office report in the very early 90s that warned that an essential degree of consensus and political commitment within Russia was lacking. But somehow, we all thought it could be finessed. Sobchak, Anatoly, mayor of St. Petersburg, just before the 91 coup that took Gorbachev out of action, he said, in this country, dictatorship and democracy live side by side. Again, it's very much what you said about Tunisia. Friends of democracies and foes of democracy. Now, Gorbachev had trouble coming around to dropping the so-called socialist option. But there had been a popular consensus, more or less, I hope you'll agree, Masha, in 1989, on what Russians at least wanted to get rid of. They knew what they wanted to get rid of. What they didn't have any sense of was what would replace it, apart from dreamy slogans. And reformers, in pushing too fast on reforms to replace it all, created shock. They created shock, but without the therapy. And they lost that consensus support, which is vital for change. And opponents in the Duma increasingly blocked any possibility of building a meaningful legal framework for reform because they were so blindly hostile to Yeltsin. I give you the U.S. Congress today. Consistency, the need of consistency and outside support. It should never have been about us. It never was about us. It was their event. But we pushed, Mahmoud is here, but we pushed the specious Washington consensus, the neoliberal consensus that growth and open markets would cushion change while having no grasp of the social consequences. Very much, I found that discussion on Egypt very relevant. You know, GDP in Russia contracted every year between 1991 and 1998 to the tune of 43% aggregate, 43%. Now, the General Accounting Office reported the significance of the fact that Russia had almost no exposure to the Western market culture and principles it set out to adopt, and with a vacuum in terms of internal institutions, but nobody was paying attention. And Russians who felt diminished as a nation blamed our policy prescriptions for the absence of a social safety net to cushion the impact of change, including democracy, because we were so avidly supporting those we labeled Democrats. And that's when democracy support began to seem to have an anti-Russian agenda, which nationalists and communists pumped, and Putin eventually took on board as his own. You know, it's obvious that terrorism, thuggery, corruption were not caused by Democrats. But Democrats in Russia were blamed for having let it happen. Now, our intentions obviously were the opposite. You know, Clinton met at the summit with Yeltsin 18 times. Gore met with Chernomyrdin in that vice presidential commission 10 times. Everything I've said, Clinton understood. He got it better than I do. But he couldn't challenge Congress, which was hostile to aid for Russia. You know, in 1992, in April, George H.W. Bush pledged in a big press conference $24 billion to support transformation in Russia. Well, Russia did not see a single digit fraction of that money. All told, I'm using G8 figures, but all told, all donors, all democracy donors, plus the international financial institutions, in the decade of the 90s, put out about $66 billion. But only $5 billion of that was grants. The rest was loans, by the way, repaid. Most of the grants were in the form of technical assistance. And I'm not telling you something you don't know. Most of the money didn't go to Russians. The money went to Western consultants. I can make your hair stand on end and tell you stories of these $1,500 a day people telling people from a country which they did not understand at all about things that the people they were talking to did not understand at all. The IMF put out $20 billion in loans, all to the central government, paid back. And at the same time, we through the Paris Club, were bullying Russia into taking on the burden of USSR debt, which had scaled up to $97 billion in 91 because of the food shortages I was talking about. But we didn't oblige Poland to take on the new Solidarity government, the responsibilities of its predecessor. When the price of oil dropped 50% in 97, the IMF was there too little, too late. Russia crashed. World Bank put out $12 billion. I'm not going to repeat the same story. Because we knew we were coming up short in aid, we were then less keen, able to push Yeltsin and Russia hard enough on issues where we should have. Corruption. Elections. Steve Fish has covered every election in Russia. And the extent to which we did not, in 96, complain about the monopolization of media and everything else that was going on in that election, precisely because, one, we were afraid otherwise the communists might win, Zyuganov would win the election, and two, because we knew we were just way, way behind on our promises on everything else. I conclude. You know, the changes in Russia, as I said before, are vast. The ambition for change was as vast as any humans have had. The changes that have occurred are vast, and you will hear later where they come up short and where they may succeed. Effective governance needs security, safety, and sustained support. Capacity building for an inclusive democracy takes time, sequencing, and coalition building. I ask you, have we learned from this experience? Obviously, maybe we've learned that nothing can be taken for granted. But I'm not sure that we've learned so easily in dealing with countries in crisis to think of what it is like to be them, not about how they can be like us. I give you Iraq. You know, it's their transformation, and each trajectory, each time, is always going to be different. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ambassador. If you're going to call me Provost, I'll call you Ambassador. Our next speaker is my longtime colleague, Ned Walker, who is the executive director of the Berkeley Program in Soviet and Post-Soviet Studies and an associate adjunct professor in the Department of Political Science here at Berkeley. His research interests focus on the relationship between beliefs and institutions in the Soviet Union and its successor states. He's the author of the book Dissolution, Sovereignty and the Breakup of the Soviet Union, and of many influential articles, including Crime Without Punishment, The Litvinenko Affair and Putin's Culture of Violence, Islam, Territory and Contested Space in Post-Soviet Russia, and Islam, Islamism and Political Order in Central Asia. Ned Walker.
Well, Thank you, George, and thank you all for coming this afternoon. Let me begin with a few words about the panel title, which is The Russian Democratic Revolution, 1989 to 1996, a title that I was given, not one that I came up with. So to a certain extent, I'm speculating on the background of the title. But anyway, presumably we start with 1989, because that was the year in which Yeltsin used elections to the Russian legislature to launch the political campaign that would eventually bring about the collapse of the Soviet regime and the dissolution of the Soviet state in 1991. Although it's important to remember that actually the great transformation, or if you prefer, revolution in Russia, actually began several years earlier, at least 3.5 years earlier, with the launching with Gorbachev's arrival in power and the launching of Perestroika, and an enormous amount had already happened by 1989. The bookend year, 1996, was presumably chosen because Yeltsin was reelected president that summer, at which point I think most commentators would agree that there was no longer any serious prospect that communists would come to power in Moscow and attempt some kind of restoration of the status quo ante. But again, it's important to remember that 1996 hardly marked an end to political instability and acute economic hardship in Russia, which continued for at least another decade. So the broad point is that the Great Transformation lasted much longer than the 7 years listed in the title, and arguably lasted 20 years, or up to 20 years, or even up to this day by some standards. So as for the phrase democratic revolution, I have no particular problem with the term revolution as long as we understand it to mean something like dramatic political, economic, and social change, and as long as we remember that the revolution in Russia was largely a nonviolent one. But I do think that characterizing that revolution as democratic, full stop, is rather misleading, however one defines the term democracy. But because it suggests a measure of regime consolidation in 1996 that I don't think was there, and also because Russia at that time was at best a partial democracy, and one that would become increasingly less so over the coming years. Okay, so where were we then in 1996? That summer, as I said, Yeltsin was reelected president, defeating the communist candidate Gennady Zyuganov in a second round runoff with 54% of the vote. That election was arguably the most democratic presidential election in Russia's post-Soviet history, despite many of the constraints on fully free and fair elections that Jeremy referred to earlier. But it was the most democratic in the sense that it was the last one in which there was really any uncertainty about the outcome. Yeltsin barely won a plurality in the first round, getting 34% of the vote to Zyuganov's 34%, and it was not at all clear that he would win the second round. Whether his victory was a product of the loans for shares deal that we've already discussed, and that he and his team entered into with some of Russia's leading oligarchs at the time, we can't say. We can't say how necessary that was. We don't know whether Yeltsin would have won without it. But what is clear is that his team believed that it was necessary to ensure Yeltsin's reelection. And as a result, the deal happened. So Yeltsin's victory was purchased at a very high price, one that would have very unfortunate long-term consequences for Russia's political economy and for the regime's legitimacy, in my view. So that said, it's again important to remember that by 1996, an enormous amount of political drama had already unfolded in Russia after the collapse of the Soviet state. 2 years earlier, a brutal war had broken out in Chechnya. The year before that, a new constitution had been adopted after a violent confrontation in the streets of Moscow, and the shelling of the Russian parliament building by government tanks. And some 2 years prior to that, the Yeltsin government had launched the program of radical and extremely painful economic reforms, entailing very rapid, or basically immediate, price liberalization, and a very rapid privatization program that would set the stage for the loans for shares deal in 1996. So in short, by 1996, by the summer of 96, when Yeltsin is reelected, a great many political milestones had already been passed and choices had been made that accounted not only for where Russia was in 1996, but in large measure where it would go in the years that followed. So how to explain where we were in that summer? So at this point, let me step back and make a broad theoretical point, or really an epistemological claim, about revolutions. And to do so, I'm going to make an analogy between revolutions and baseball games. Not hockey, I'm sorry, Jeremy, but baseball. In baseball, we do not know and cannot know how sensitive the outcome of any particular game is to initial or early conditions. If there are two outs with nobody on in the ninth inning and the score is 4-1, we can be very confident that the team with a 3-run lead is going to win. But what we do not know and cannot know is what the outcome would have been had a single, very small decision been made differently in the early parts of the game. Many fans, of course, talk as if that weren't the case. So if only Tim Lincecum hadn't thrown that pitch that was hit out of the park for a grand slam in the third inning, then we would have won 1-0. Or if only Buster Posey had thrown out that guy at second base earlier in that inning, the inning would have been over and there would have been no grand slam and we would have won 1-0. But the truth is that we have no idea what the outcome would have been if anything early in the game had actually been different. In fact, we don't even know how the outcome would have been different if Lincecum had gotten a better night's sleep the night before or had one less beer than he actually had. Mm-hmm. And something as simple as a different pitch call by Posey in the first inning might well have led him to choose a different pitch call at that critical moment when the guy hit the grand slam in the third inning. So the point is that we have no way of knowing how different the final score would be in any particular game if we assume that something different had happened early on. So baseball games may or may not be extremely sensitive to initial or early conditions. We really don't know. All we can say is that later on in the game, it becomes much easier to predict outcomes, and indeterminacy diminishes. So my own view is that revolutions are very similar, and that is we cannot say with confidence how different any particular outcome would be had things been different or different choices been made early on in the process. As time passes and constraints on choices increase, it becomes easier to make predictions. For example, one could say with confidence that it was very unlikely that Russia would fall apart when Putin came to office at the beginning of 2000. But that is not a claim that you can make with any confidence at the beginning of 1992 in the immediate aftermath of the Soviet collapse. And indeed, that was something that a great many people were extremely worried about, just as people were worried that Russia was going to experience widespread violence throughout the country, which, of course, happily did not happen. So likewise, I would say we really have no idea what's going to happen to the Arab Spring countries today because it's still so early in the game. Whereas in 5 years, the open-endedness of today will presumably have diminished, and it will be much easier to start talking about what the likely path forward for these countries actually is. So too with Russia in 1992. I believed then, and I believe now, that the political future of Russia at that time was very open-ended in this immediate aftermath of the great Soviet dissolution. But it became increasingly less so over time, and indeed less so by the time we get to 1996. So what had narrowed those options? Part of the answer lies in factors over which Russia's leaders really had no control. So internationally, there was the U.S. recession of 1990-91, the first Iraq war in 1992, the war in the former Yugoslavia, the Maastricht Agreement, which diverted the attention of the European leadership and, you know, signaled a commitment to what was then called deepening rather than widening of the European project at the time. Then there was the Clinton administration's decision to expand NATO. There was the 1994 congressional elections that Jeremy referred to. And so, you know, the broad point is that there were a host of international factors that came into play that made for a less benign international environment than might have otherwise been the case. Even more important, in my view, were the political constraints that increased over time as a result of the dramatic, prolonged, and in my view, inevitable economic slump that Russia went through as it was going through the transition from a fully planned economy to a market economy. And that very painful process inevitably sucked a lot of the capital out of whoever was in office or whoever would have been in office in Moscow at the time. There were, however, a great many political decisions that were made by Yeltsin and his allies at that time that I thought then were mistakes and that I think now were mistakes, and that I think had they been made differently, we might have seen a more liberal, more democratic outcome further down the road that would have been better solution for Russia's people. So let me point to three critical moments in particular. First, there was the decision by Yeltsin in late 1991, early 1992, not to dissolve the Russian legislature and call for new elections that spring. Now, I remember hoping at the time that he would, and then, you know, people thought that was something that he was likely to do or might well do. And I remember hoping at the time that he would also call for presidential elections to follow that. Again, something that I very much hoped he would do. And I also hoped, and not too many people thought this was likely, but I'm generally naive, so I thought maybe he would. I also hoped that he would have the good sense not to run in those elections. Like most Western observers, I thought that Yeltsin had played a critical role bringing down the old order, particularly during the failed coup of August 1991. But I also thought that he was an erratic and impulsive man with serious health issues and a serious drinking problem, as we all know. And I thought the country would be much better off with a more sober-minded, literally and figuratively, pro-democracy leader with less personal baggage. Of course, neither parliamentary nor presidential elections were held that year, and instead Yeltsin and the Russian legislature entered into an increasingly acerbic and dysfunctional political conflict with still very unclear rules of the game that would culminate in the violence of October 1993 and the shelling of the Russian parliament. Yeltsin eventually won that contest, but he did so at great cost to his credibility and to the regime's claim to democratic legitimacy. And Russia was also saddled, as a result of all of this, with an increasingly unpopular, unstable, and unhealthy leader for the next 8 years. So let us just say Yeltsin was no Mandela. A second critical moment. I believe Yeltsin and his allies made a serious mistake in designing the new constitution that was adopted in December 1993. Like Steve Fish, who's written a great deal about this, I think that the super presidential system that was provided for by that constitution was very ill-suited to Russia under its circumstances, above all because it concentrated so much power in the hands of the president. And as a result, it did a very poor job of distributing blame. Now, I knew, and I think most people knew, that Russia was very likely to go through a prolonged period of economic stress. That transiting to a market economy was going to inevitably be very painful and take a very long time. And that meant that there was going to be a lot of blame to go around. And so it would be a good idea if that blame were reasonably widely dispersed throughout the political elite. parliamentary systems, or at least presidential systems with strong checks and balances, are much better at distributing blame. And in fact, the super presidential system that they adopted in 1993 could not be better designed to concentrate blame in the hands of whoever it was in office, and also discredit whoever was in office's project at that time. So it had the consequence of concentrating blame in Yeltsin and at the same time discrediting the whole democratic project. Finally, a third critical moment. There was the war in Chechnya that broke out in late 1994. Again, I felt at the time and feel to this day that that war was not inevitable. In no small part, much of the blame rests, in my view, with Chechnya's then very reckless leader, Dzhokhar Dudayev. But it was also the result of the failure of Russia's leadership to negotiate a deal with the Chechens over the course of 1994, a deal that on many occasions looked like it was imminent. It looked like they were very close to some arrangement. Then the negotiations broke down, tensions intensified. But even after negotiations broke down and the Chechens seized and threatened to behead a number of Russian servicemen on Russian television, which let us say was quite provocative, you can imagine an American president would react to that inside, you know, U.S. territory as recognized internationally. Despite that, Yeltsin and his advisors had the option of ordering a punitive strike against the Chechen, you know, opposition forces, or at least a limited military operation that was short of a full-bore invasion and attempt to occupy all of the region. As it turned out, the invasion and attempted occupation led to a horribly destructive war between 1994 and 1996 that was followed by another horribly destructive war that broke out at the end of 1999, and that, in my view, goes a long way to explain why it is that Yeltsin ended up taking such a, Putin ended up taking such a sort of strong arm approach to politics and, you know, after he came into office. So anyway, to conclude, these are just three critical junctures in a period of critical junctures, the ones that I remember as the most important. There were doubtless many more, some of which we may not even know about. Now, while I cannot say for certain how different the outcome would have been had different choices been made in that period, in other words, how path-dependent the post-Soviet transition in Russia was, my view is that the burden rests with those who claim that it wasn't open-ended, that it wasn't path-dependent, for the simple reason that it was so difficult to make predictions as the events themselves unfolded. The future feels indeterminate in these moments because I believe it really is indeterminate. What some may treat as inevitable or structurally driven after the fact, with the benefit of hindsight, does not seem that way to anyone at the time these events are transpiring. Whether we were talking about Russia in 1992 or Egypt in 2012, now, I will conclude with one other thing, which is George gave me the perfect suggested title for this talk, which, you know, well, maybe I should have introduced it with, but it was The Putsch Not Taken. So, leave it with that. Thank you.
We now have plenty of time, 40 more minutes for discussion. I would like to start with a question for Ambassador Kinsman. You began by arguing that a successful transition is more likely to work if it's based on pacting. One could argue that Gorbachev's gradualism was based on, even if he didn't conceptualize it that way, on some kind of pacting. You then, when you turn to the Yeltsin era, argue that they didn't understand how to do it, and we didn't understand how to do it, but we gave them advice that was counterproductive and led them down the wrong path. Would we, had we understood it, have had the ability to lead them down the right path?
Well, I think...
Was this tragedy or was this mistake?
I think you're putting me in the edge.
and Ned's narrative as trying to say if this had happened, this would have happened. And but I think you're right. I think Gorbachev's mistakes, Basha, were lack of decisiveness, lack of commitment, lack of understanding. He sort of knew what he wanted to do, but he didn't really know. He took one step sideways, one step forward, one step back, two steps sideways. And a lot of it, as time went on, Yakovlev lost his influence. In the Politburo, there are only about three reformers, you know, when you think back on it. And he began to scent the kind of atmosphere around him, and he backed off. Now, as you know, I mean, famously, I think it was Jack Matlock, but I can't remember, went and told him that a putsch was brewing, and he didn't agree. He didn't believe it. I'm not sure that, given who the opposition was, and let's put the nationalists aside, the opposition were the people who used to hold power, who were in government, the nomenklatura, the equivalent of the people you were talking about. And they wanted to hold on to power. I'm not sure that psychologically, temperamentally, politically, ideologically, the United States government could have brought itself to urge Gorbachev to make a deal or to pact with them. I'm not sure if it would ever have been enough. That would be my feeling. So I don't know if it could have gone that way. Later on, with Yeltsin, I think that the atmosphere had deteriorated to such a point that I honestly don't think that pacting was possible. I think that's why they did loans for shares. I think they thought they had to prevail. I'm talking about Yeltsin and the reformers, that these guys were never going to give up. And right up until the election in 2000, you know, when Primakov was seen as being, at that point, the principal champion of that gang of people, and which is why they picked Putin. So I don't know. So it's true. I've advanced the wonderful theory of pacting as being essential, and now I'm kind of washing my hands of it as far as reality at that time was concerned, and it's extremely inconvenient that you were incisive enough to point this out, however. Thank you.
Henry?
John, for Ned, thanks. Is this on?
Yeah.
Okay. You really didn't mention the party system in Russia, and especially Yeltsin's focus on personalistic rule and failure to really do much to make democratic Russia more powerful or strong or a real party, and even to then in a larger context to encourage other parties and maybe more civil society. Is that also a mistake that was made? Was there a chance that he could have said, let's make democratic Russia into a real party, let's encourage a party system, and then there'll be something besides just me?
Well, so my view is that the best way to encourage the development of political parties rapidly in conditions where they're either absent or largely weak or very weak is to have a parliament that matters and to hold elections. So it goes to this, you know, a parliament that was in place at the beginning of 1992 was the parliament that was elected in 1989. It was a Soviet era parliament with different kinds of people in it. It wasn't a uniform body by any stretch of the imagination. But if you wanted to develop parties, not calling elections early on and having this prolonged struggle with in a very dysfunctional system with very unclear rules of the game that ends up leading to this, you know, violent confrontation with the opposition in October 1993, and then basically you know, ramming a constitution through or just pushing a constitution through, you know, in circumstances where people really didn't have a chance to really consider it. And, I mean, you know, I wrote about this at the time. And that, you know, there was a lot of fighting over that constitution between 92 and 93. But it was mostly between people who were involved in the drafting of it. And there wasn't, you know, it wasn't something that was, you know, where there was a lot of transparency and a lot of public discussion. So anyway, the long and the short of it, yes, I would say for sure. But the best way, in my view at the time and in my view now, to begin to strengthen the Russian parliamentary system would have been to adopt an order where parliament actually mattered and then hold elections and repeated elections. And I think parliamentary systems are much better for that. But you, at least you're going to have, if you're going to have a presidential system, you need a parliament that matters.
Lucan?
Ned.
Hello, Lucan.
Now, you're quite a radical voluntarist for a Berkeley guy. I don't know what happened to you in the last 5 years. Do you really mean that we have no idea whether there's going to be democracy in the Arab world? First question. Second question, I want to just press you a little bit on the on your counterfactuals. So let's say we had held, you know, elections in 92. I mean, we had a crappy economy. Would we really have had, you know, a lot of pro-democratic, pro-Yeltsin people elected? And even if he had, then, you know, would they have really not been in conflict with the president? When we had parliamentary presidential conflicts in virtually all post-Soviet cases, you know, regardless of constitution, including those with strong parliaments. And furthermore, more broadly, I mean, if really Russia's road was so open, wouldn't we expect a greater variety of regime outcomes in the CIS? I mean, i.e. the former Soviet states that were not given the option of EU membership. I mean, basically, you didn't have democratic success anywhere. So doesn't that kind of tell you that perhaps there were bigger structural factors at work? And finally, sorry, with regards to, I'm willing to believe that a crappy constitution led to a crappy outcome, i.e. authoritarianism, but just can you just give me a little bit more about in what way the specific rules of the constitution contributed to authoritarianism under Putin? I mean, I'm not, this is not a rhetorical question, it's a real question.
That's too many questions, Lucan.
Okay.
Well, I don't know about you, but I certainly do not know what's going to happen to the Arab Spring countries. As a structuralist, doubtless you do, but I don't. As a voluntarist. When I say no idea, I mean, I just repeat what I said before. I think the, you know, I mean, my impression of all of our discussions, you know, over the last 2 days is that there is an enormous amount of uncertainty, not equally in all the Arab Spring countries, but, to some degree in all of them, and in some key cases like, Egypt, an enormous amount of indeterminacy. I don't know what's going to happen there, for sure. So counterfactuals, what were they? What was the first one? Was how a different constitution would have mattered?
92.
Oh, elections in 92. Okay, so you know, first off, the option of holding parliamentary elections early in 92 was something that was widely discussed at the time, and people didn't know whether Yeltsin was going to do it. So it wasn't something that was, you know, clearly wacko Ned Walker, you know, irrelevant hope. And I would say it was to a large extent true also of presidential elections. I just repeat what I said to Henry. Like, I think, you know, that would have, in the first place, it would have avoided all of that incredibly dysfunctional fighting that took place that led to this, you know, very unfortunate, conflict in the streets of Moscow in October 1993. I mean, not everywhere were tanks shelling parliament buildings.
You didn't have democracy anymore.
Well, anywhere in former Soviet space, and the other, and you certainly did in Eastern Europe, and under, you know, similar circumstances. You certainly did in the Baltic republics, which are post-Soviet states. So that is a broad claim that is incorrect. but the other argument you can make in response to that is Russia mattered a lot. And if Russia had gone one way, the other countries might well have gone a different direction. And I agreed with the Clinton administration, and Strobe Talbot at the time, that basically as goes Russia, so goes the rest of the region. I mean, that's an exaggeration, but I mean, Russia was critically important. So anyway, I'm not, we can talk about all the other ones afterwards. But yeah, so the counterfactuals are always counterfactuals. But I did say I don't know what would have happened, but I'd say the burden is on you to show that you do. And if you can in the Arab case, I don't think you could in the Russian case either.
On the dimensions of this conference, it seems to me that the mistakes we should be talking about primarily are the mistakes that were made by us and not the mistakes that were made in Russia. And if we take Professor Walker's dimensions, which I totally agree with, and go back to the beginning of perestroika, I could give three. I think I'll just raise the issue of two mistakes that I think are critical. The first one was in the Gorbachev era. You remember that if there's any single factor that weakened Gorbachev, it was a disastrous decline in oil prices, which meant that the budgets that they had drawn up for, social restructuring were just not there. And a CIA senior official has boasted of the CIA's role in manipulating oil prices in that time, which I think was a disastrous mistake. They were trying to get rid of Gorbachev. You have to remember that CIA estimates for a decade were being falsified in order to make Russia look like America's number one enemy, where in fact Reagan had a better estimate of what was happening than the official CIA estimates, which produced a kind of internal revolution in the CIA from the people like Ray McGovern who knew that the facts were being cooked. So I think that was a terrible mistake, and it reflects very badly on Bob Gates, who went on to be an architect of later phases of American policy. And the second mistake that I think was, and it's a current one, the expansion of NATO. I was in Moscow in May, and I heard from all kinds of people the claim, and this is a question of fact that maybe can be answered, that Yeltsin had been promised that in exchange for the deals he was making, that there would be no expansion of NATO, and that promise was broken. I don't know whether that's true or not, but I heard it over and over. And in the eyes of the people who were talking to me about this, that the expansion of NATO into former Soviet territories, the Baltic states, and I believe it's still on the agenda to go into the Ukraine, which seems to me absolute madness. They see that as a kind of expanded great game that was in sync with what was happening in the oil states of Central Asia. So is that not also a terrible mistake, and does it not reflect on, or I'll just give the Russian view of it, does it not from Russian eyes make it look as if America really is pursuing the kind of global dominance that we read about in Pentagon documents from this time?
Jeremy?
Spoken like a true Canadian, Peter. We're from the American near abroad, I really have three very quick points. On the Soviet debt, when after the price of oil had declined by 50% and Gorbachev was forced to borrow money basically to import food, because at the same time the Soviet supply system had broken down, and debt, state debt, spiraled to 37% of GDP at that point. This was, I think, probably the straw that broke the camel's back. I absolutely agree with you. I think that events were misconstrued in Washington, I think in London as well.
other capitals, in my own capital, there was vigorous debate. A lot of people couldn't let the Cold War go. And you have a presidential candidate right now who's talking about Russia as its America's number one geostrategic foe. Where did that come from? You know, it came from the past. And people were just too locked into the past to be able to cope with change in the present. And I think that's what we were talking about in the last panel. On NATO expansion, I mean, I went through that debate with your best friend, Brian Mulroney, and others. Look, here's the deal. First of all, there was no deal. Okay, I have heard directly from Gorbachev several times. I used to see Gorbachev because Brian Mulroney gave him $1 million to start his foundation. So I drank a lot of coffee with him. And he always insisted this. I knew Jim Baker very well, and I confronted him with it. Jim Baker did not promise that. I think it was lost in translation, in fact, at that specific meeting between Baker and Gorbachev. Baker was talking about East Germany and saying that NATO would not replace the 700,000 Soviet troops that were going to leave East Germany with NATO troops. Gorbachev inferred that to mean that NATO wasn't going to move eastward more generally. As a matter of fact, originally people didn't want to. I remember Manfred Werner telling a NATO meeting, and I'm going to guess and say it was in early 1990, that, listen, guys, the one thing we got to do is to keep the Warsaw Pact together, because it was seen as a stabilizing kind of framework for this extraordinary transformation that was occurring. Havel originally thought that the Visegrad three countries could kind of choose a third way, you know? But he soon lost that. You know why he lost it? I guess I speak as somebody whose wife is a Czech political refugee. But he lost it because, at the end of the day, the Czechs and the Poles and the Hungarians, and I had Czechs and Slovaks and Poles and Hungarians, had lost three generations of European identity. You know, the electricity grids, the highways, everything went east. And these were peoples who had lived west, not east. And damned if they were going to be denied the opportunity to get back into the west, because the guys who made them look to the east supposedly had some sort of a veto over what they were going to become. So what happened? It wasn't just the Polish vote in Chicago and so on and so forth. It became a moral issue. And I think at that time, the Soviets understood, certainly Kozyrev, understood, and Yeltsin, understood that with respect to those three countries, or it became four countries, that there wasn't an issue. Later on, it became a bigger issue. I don't think of Bulgaria and Romania, but when it turned to the Baltic countries, because that was a line, they had been part of the Soviet Union. But how did they get to be part of the Soviet Union? I think, you know, a certain amount of self-criticism, the potential for that existed even in the Kremlin, and they could get that. Ukraine and Georgia? No way. No way. And Saakashvili put the boots to that 3 summers ago. And that isn't going to happen, Peter, at least not in the immediate future. We'll see what happens in the American presidential election, but I don't think the Europeans are at all in favor of that. So that's my take on NATO. I want to add, if I may, George, one point about Ned, who has finally vexed me by referring 3 times to the shelling of the Russian parliament in 1993. Okay, I lived in Moscow at the time. Boy, did I ever welcome the shelling of that parliament. And by the way, there were 18 shells. All but 2 were dummies, okay? The people who were being shelled had just killed about 25 people the night before, including killing 6 journalists on the lawn of the Ostankino television tower. And when television inevitably went off that night,
Moscow residents went to sleep not knowing what the hell they were going to be facing the next morning. And Hasbulatov and Rutskoy and all those Afghanis on the flatbed trucks with the AK-47s and everything, they looked an awful lot that night that they might indeed take the town. So when people woke up on that Monday morning and there were four tanks lined up outside the parliament and there were two big bangs, and then, and, you know, there was that huge private arsenal that Hasbulatov had taken over, a 5,000-man strong Duma private army, in effect. People in Moscow were mighty happy. And so I know that sometimes, you know, media gets it wrong and they attach the wrong labels to things. But the thing to remember is not the shelling of parliament in that. It was that this was an attempted coup by people who absolutely were anti-democratic.
So, General, let me respond. First point is, in referring to that incident, my basic point is that it was too bad that it came to that. Not that I didn't hope that the Yeltsin forces would prevail at that moment.
Yeah, you've won my heart.
I did. I absolutely did. But it was a very, it was, you know, something that would have been much better to avoid, I believe could have been avoided if they'd had, held parliamentary elections earlier.
Ruby Unger, I'm so glad for this panel. I've been waiting 15 years to ask this question. My husband and I were foot soldiers in the Market Reform Army sent by USAID to the former Soviet countries of Moldova and Ukraine. And it really appeared to me pretty quickly that it's going to take two generations for anything to really be accomplished in any way whatsoever, resembling like anything like us, or just something that would give people good jobs, respectful jobs. The doctors, who were mostly women, now working as cleaning ladies, making a lot more money, and now having electrical appliances and so forth, which they never had before working as doctors. I came to understand that a man named Jeffrey Sachs was the foundation of our economic program there. Why? Why did he have so much sway within our government to sort of foist this theory that it was clear to me? I can't speak for my husband, but it was pretty clear to me.
Oh, sure you can.
Oh, all right. We went with a budget, and we knew that when we left, also the budget would leave. And written into our deliverables was the idea that by magic, after 3 years or 4 years on the ground, they'd be able to pick up and move on the same way, with the same jobs that we were giving them funding for. Okay, thank you.
I just say two things and turn it to you, Ned. Sachs, as I recall, was not a USAID consultant. I think he was working for the IFIs, and he had done a sort of shock therapy precursor in Poland, which was, as a situation and as an economy and as a country, much less complex, okay? And it was thought, it had more time, and it was thought to have worked. But his thinking was adopted. I don't know the extent to which he so thoroughly seduced people in Washington. The people he thoroughly seduced, as I recall, were the reformers in Moscow. That was the issue. Can I tell the audience just an anecdote affecting the Unger family, which will illustrate to you some of the vagaries of attempting to help countries pull themselves up by their bootstraps? Alan and Ruby Unger were in the wonderful city, whatever the capital of Moldova is. Forgive me.
Depending on
Excuse me for that moment of that lapse. And Alan was shocked to discover, coming home, that their apartment had been burgled and that a whole lot of stuff had been stolen, including a lot of his clothes and, you know, the hi-fi and things like that. 2 days later, he had an appointment with the Minister of Energy to talk about serious infrastructure issues, and he walked in, and the Minister of Energy was wearing his suit. So this is not a story about Russia, okay? It's not a story about Russia. I'm just talking about how you got to be sort of fast on your feet, and you win some, you lose some, you know? So, there you go.
George, can I just say something about that? There is just one point I want to make. First off, what Jeremy said is true. It's basically, Sachs was asked to give his advice. I have no doubt that he gave the advice that he thought was most appropriate. And I don't believe there was any path forward for Russia that did not entail a huge amount of stress. And I think it is actually, I think it's virtually completely wrong to make the claim that public officials and academics, particularly economists who are specialists on the former Soviet Union, did not appreciate how difficult, prolonged this transition would be. I certainly knew. I can show you stuff I wrote at the time saying, you know, they are in for one big S-storm for a very long period of time. And I can show you countless things that were written at that time about how difficult, and, you know, everyone understood that the institutions were not in place. You didn't have the skills. You didn't have accountants. You didn't have people understand about tax systems. You didn't have, you know, lawyers. You didn't have, you know, all the things that are absolutely essential to a normal functioning market economy were virtually completely absent in Russia. The other thing I'd just say is that these were not potted plants, the people who were, or, you know, helpless reeds, the people who were making these decisions. It had already been a really long period of incredibly stressful and conflictual debates over economic reform in the Soviet Union. There's the Shatalin plan. There were all these people that had, you know, been involved in all this stuff. They didn't just start, you know, de novo, at the beginning of 92. And that winter of 91-92 was arguably the worst moment in the whole transition period. It was a period, if you'll recall, where we were actually, you know, these famous Bush's legs, you know, the chickens that were being sent over there in that winter was because, you know, the West was afraid and the Bush administration was afraid that there'd actually be hunger in Russia over that winter. So it was humanitarian assistance, not loans, not... So, you know, first off, appreciate the intensity of the crisis at that time, appreciate that it had already been going on for some substantial period of time, and appreciate that everybody was struggling with, you know, to figure out some path forward. And there was no sense of what the best thing to do, other than that what Gorbachev had been doing was not working.
Yeah.
My question about your last remarks, it's interesting about chicken. So it's a profit for American companies, or is it humanitarian help to Russia? And also, what do you think about the policy of double standards and how this policy affect development of Russia and diplomacy, democracy in Russia? Thank you.
Well, I don't know. It was Tyson's chicken, as I recall. Clinton made a big deal out of it because Tyson's was located in Arkansas. I don't know if they made a lot of money out of it. But, you know, food aid traditionally in the United States, forgive me for saying, has always been much more to the profit of the suppliers than to the recipients. That's a fine American tradition. And I don't see, since you're talking about consistency, why there should be such a vast exception for Russia. But I agree with Ned totally that, you know, one cannot overlook the amount of genuine attention in 1991, 92, 93 to the plight of ordinary Russians and to the enormous number of humanitarian projects that were going on. I mean, I know we flew in gynecological and other stuff
We came in an aircraft in the ring around Moscow and landing at airports that you know, 2 years before had Soviet interceptors that would have shot us down. I mean, these were quite remarkable events and days, and I think people were extremely goodwilled about it. I mean, I don't get me wrong about that. And when it came to humanitarian assistance, we just didn't do enough. And, you know, we were talking about Egypt this morning. If you consider that the amount of grant aid from all Western democracies and the IFIs amounted to $5 billion over 10 years, I think that, if I'm right, is just about the amount of bilateral aid by the United States to Egypt and Israel in 1 year. Okay? So that's also a question about consistency that you raised.
Thanks. Steve Hansen, William & Mary. I was originally on this panel, but actually I was sent a program before I came where I was on the last panel, so I prepared for that one. So for those who can stay to the end, I'll get a longer shot at it. But I thought since my name's on the program, I could take just 2 minutes to say a couple of things in response to the really interesting conversation. Actually, 3 points. First is we didn't talk about the role of area studies, and I think this whole conference has been a ringing affirmation of the importance of knowing your region, knowing your country, knowing your language, knowing what's going on the ground. We've all learned so much about what's happening in the world today from that. And unfortunately, the Soviet-Russian democratic transition 91 and on took place at the height of the attack on area studies in academia, which maybe has won. I don't know. In some disciplines, it certainly has. For those of us who got their PhDs at UC Berkeley in 1991, such as myself and some others in the room around that time, we had the experience actually of being in rooms with some of those folks with all this advice who didn't know anything at all about the countries they were entering. It wasn't so much, I think, the counterfactual that, you know, one different piece of advice is like Buster Posey's good pitch and, you know, Russia becomes a thriving democracy because the lecture was better delivered or something. But it is true, I do think, that the cumulative effect of patronizing lectures by young somethings, you know, who didn't know anything about Russia did have a damaging effect that still felt today in U.S.-Russian relations over time. And it wasn't necessarily, it was a self-inflicted wound that was basically due to this very strange moment that we've gone through where we decided that area-specific knowledge is irrelevant to intellectual conversations. It's as if in evolutionary biology, scientists insisted that collecting fossils was no longer useful. One should only theorize about evolution. That's where we are as a science. So it strikes me that we've learned, actually, and this is relevant to the Arab Spring examples, that knowing on-the-ground detail is crucial, just as theory and comparison is crucial. Second point is about prediction. So I guess I'm with Lucan on the debate between Walker and Way here. It's true if you could never point back and say anybody was more right or wrong, you know, in retrospect, then there'd be no grounds for making predictions about the future in the current examples. But there were traditions that were more right and ones that were more wrong. And I think it's fair to say by now, 20 years later, that the folks who were focusing on, in particular, legacies of the Soviet past, the trauma of the transformation, not transition, of post-Soviet life, that is the complexity of it, and the importance of identity, the importance of looking at the ways in which Russia and other post-Soviet states were defining national identity, defining democratic belonging and citizenship. Those approaches proved more productive and more predictive than ones, for example, that focused on formal institutional rules, the nature of the Constitution of 93, which, by the way, is now a dead letter, the nature of fiscal federalism, which has all been overturned, the specific rules for electing local parliaments. Those things turned out to matter less, especially when you compare with other post-Soviet cases. If we're looking at the macro outcome of democratic consolidation in the post-Soviet space, what really mattered was legacies of the past. If you had 74 years of Leninism, you had a really hard time coming out of it. And if, like the Baltic states, I'm sorry to say, or the rest of Central and Eastern Europe, you had one generation of that experiment imposed on you, it was better. And being a smaller country bordering prosperous Western Europe was obviously a lot better than being a giant country in the middle of Eurasia. By the way, geography I don't think affects culture in the slightest, in contrast to what was said yesterday. But it certainly does affect abilities to get foreign direct investment, to guarantee property rights, to get included in international organizations like NATO, EU, and so forth. So the bad geography, the incredibly difficult legacy, and the struggle over identity, I think, did matter a lot. And, sorry, some of us were looking at that back in the early 90s and getting outvoted. So I think for today's transitions in the Arab world, we should be doing the same. We should take these countries as separate, not as all one block. That's been a point made repeatedly. It's correct. We should look at the specific institutional legacies of autocratic rule in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, which differ from one another in a variety of dimensions. We should look at geography, like the point about the Mediterranean and the way that that can be redefined, the difficulty a country like Syria has with its geography relative to a country like Tunisia. Actually, I think they're quite differently located in ways that are important, and the struggle for identity, which we've talked a lot about. Those are the variables that will matter more, I think, if the post-communist experiment teaches us anything, than simply constitutions or formal policy decisions. I guess I'll stop there. Thanks.
It's really interesting. Yes, sir.
I'd just like to ask a question of either participant about foreign policy and domestic policy. Gorbachev, of course, came to Palo Alto, gave a speech, and said it's all over. Some people applauded very loud. The question was, did the mess in Afghanistan cause this to happen, or was it a relatively ancillary type of factor in the dissolution process? And then on the question of Dagestan and Chechnya, did Dagestan and Chechnya and all the wars there prevent a consolidation of a truly democratic reform in the Soviet, the post-Soviet Union?
Why don't you take the first one?
If you accept that the crisis in for the Soviet Union and for the system was a very complex, multifaceted crisis, okay? It was a moral crisis. It was a service delivery crisis. It was, to some extent, increasingly a legitimacy crisis. But it, as I think we were discussing with Peter, I think it really the one thing that, that really resonated with Gorbachev was were the books. It became an intolerable financial crisis. The presence of the Soviet military in Afghanistan was extraordinarily expensive and added to it. And there's quite a lot of confessional stuff that Soviet, now Russian, retired generals have come up with about that time, but they felt that it was extraordinarily draining in many, many ways. And I mean, I think that's the conclusion that, that Gorbachev came to, and they pulled the plug. It was also very unpopular at that point, okay? Extremely unpopular. I mean, boys were dying, and so there were lots of reasons to get out of Afghanistan, including the ones that everybody else has now learned in this particular chapter of interaction with that country, you know, that you can't win.
Well, so on Chechnya and the North Caucasus, you know, one of the points I made in the talk was that I felt like the decision to order a full-blown invasion of Chechnya in 1994 was a serious mistake. I felt that at the time. I mean, I could understand why they would launch some kind of punitive strike against Chechnya, but I did not want to see them try to occupy the whole thing because I was very worried that it was going to lead to a huge disaster. And in my view, that's exactly what happened. So again, I can't say what would have happened had there been no Chechnya. You know, to get back to sort of to Steve's point, you know, it's always going to be easy after the fact to identify structural factors that happen to look like the ones that mattered the most. Well, no, but I'm saying this so there are people who are different views of what's important, right? But someone's going to win afterwards. Someone's going to, you know, your position is either going to be vindicated or not. But at the time that it's unfolding, it's just not clear. So just with respect to the Arab countries, again, I mean, I agree with what you say. And if I were to point to, you know, facilitating conditions or things that you should be paying attention to, I would say, yes, I completely agree. As long as you appreciate the contingency, it is. These are just facilitating conditions. They are not determinative, and stuff happens, and stuff can happen that I think can be, you know, extremely important. How Morsi handles it over the next 2 years, or all sorts of things, you know.
Well, let's thank our panelists for very interesting discussion.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.